session number 24609, reel 7.
I'm a naval man. I know where to tie knots and all this sort of thing. So anyway, I said, well, okay. I said, I'll go and sit in the truck on the winch, and I'll watch the rear view mirror, and you just tell me when to pay out the winch. So he tied what he thought was a good knot, and he signaled that I was to slacken out the winch and run out the winch to let the safe slide down the hill. And only got a few feet and the knot came undone, and the safe went sliding down the hill on its own and hit a monsoon ditch at the bottom of the hill, turned over and went right through the wall of this building, demolished the wall. Fortunately enough, there was nobody inside, but it made a mess of the hill, of the building anyway. So I said to my buddy, I says, come on, I says, we'll pack up our gear and we'll get out of here before any of the big brass come around and want to know what's going on. So we packed up our gear and we wound in the winch rope and everything like that, and we got out of there. But that was another little incident that happened during my stay with 75 Company. We used to take it in turns to, as the vehicles came in for inspection, we had a hoist there and a pit that we could get underneath the vehicle and check it for oil leaks and slack in the transmission or universal joints. And we take it in turns doing the vehicles. I used to do the CNC's cars and the command secretary's cars myself, because I had the ultimate responsibility for the safety of the vehicle. So this was, I used to take that on as my personal job. So the CNC's car would come in one day, and of course on the front it had a red plate with three silver stars on it, denoting that the CNC's rank. This plate, of course, was covered up with a web cover when the CNC wasn't in the car. But during the course of the inspection and things like that, sometimes the cover would get taken off, and everything was checked, the tightness and cleanliness and things like that, and we'd forget to put the cover back on. I'd take the car out on a road test, and we'd be going through the streets of Singapore on my own, and all the officers coming along the road would be saluting the car. And when they look in the back of the car and they see nobody in the back, they get on the phone right away and demand to know who was the driver that had the plate uncovered. So Snowy would drag me in the office and give me hell about driving without the cover plate on the CNC's car. Now this was all a part of life in those days. We lived in a barracks across the street from the workshop and up the hill, and we had to walk past the RSM's office. The RSM of this particular RSC company was a RSM butcher, and he'd introduce himself. He'd say, my name is Butcher. He said, butcher by name and butcher by nature. And he used to make out that he was a real tough guy, but he wasn't too bad. We, every so often, we'd look for some kind of way to increase, put a bit of excitement into our lives. And we'd come up with Whisker Week. And Whisker Week was a week where nobody shaved. You would get away with shaving just as long as you can. And what we would do, we'd put $10 each in a kitty. And the last one to be forced to shave would win the kitty. What it, because we didn't have any parades in those days. We were strictly a workshop, and we went straight from our quarters, walked across the street to the workshop and a job. So what we did was we got up in the morning, washed and showered. We didn't shave, and you'd sneak out and you'd try to go down the sort of back way to get down and out of the camp, but eventually you'd have to go past the RSM docks. And if he caught you without shaving, he'd send you back and tell you to report to his office shaven and properly dressed. So this went on for a week or 10 days, as long as you could get away with it. And invariably the person who was the last one to shave won the kitty. So the barracks we lived in was a sort of an open, there was no windows as such, like glass windows. There was holes in the wall with wooden shutters on them, but the place we lived in was more or less an open space. And in this open space, there were probably 20 or 30 guys used to live in one area. We had one person that was posted into the camp called Swanky. I can't think of his first name. I think it was Alan. I'm not sure. Alan Swanky. And how he got into the army, I don't know. But he was a very small person. He probably only weighed about 120 pounds. But he was very immature. He hadn't developed physically. There was something the matter with his body structure or hormones or something that he hadn't developed. And he had no hair on his body. And the hair on his head was very blonde and very sort of fluffy, like a child. And he had a very high-pitched voice. His voice hadn't broken. And whenever he spoke or shouted, it sounded like a woman's voice. So when he first came to the camp and he was shouting across to somebody, everybody would be running around in the nude. They'd just come out of the shower. We'd all grab a towel to wrap around ourselves. We'd expect to see a woman coming into the quarters, but it was only Swanky. And he used to ask us if he could come into Singapore with us on one of our many drinking binges. And at first we said, no, you can't come with us. Like, you know, so, but eventually we took him with us, and he was a source of embarrassment because the other guys in the bars used to think he was a juvenile and that we were some kind of perverts. So we didn't take Swanky with us after that. But he was taking some kind of treatment, injections or hormone treatments. But how he got into the army, I don't really know. But he ended up going to Korea. He was posted to Korea. And when he got off the ship, the officer there said, "What are you doing here, boy?" And he thought he was just a boy, and they wouldn't let him off the docks. And until the next ship that was returning to Singapore, he was put in the battery section on the docks that was used to put the batteries back in the vehicles that were transported to overseas. But when he came back from Korea, he came back with the two medals, the United Nations medal, and I assume it was a Commonwealth medal or something. But it was always a big source of amusement that us guys have been out there 2.5 years, and we end up at the General Service Medal with the Malaya clasp, and Swanky ends up with 3 medals. I think eventually he got discharged from the military, I'm not too sure. But anyway, life continued at 75 Company. My time overseas was rapidly coming to a close. I remember one incident where we got into a bit of trouble, which didn't amount to too much. We've been drinking in the local canteen, and as I was a Lance Corporal, I was supposed to drink in the, they had a corporal's mess, and I was supposed to drink in there with the corporals, but most of my friends were craftsmen, privates, so I'd borrow somebody else's jacket with no stripes on it to go to their canteen, and we'd drink in there. We were in there one Saturday night, and we'd all had a whole pile of beer bottles stashed in front of us, drinking away, and time came to close the bar, and we said, well, we got 6 big quart bottles of beer left over, what are we going to do? So we decided to get a fire bucket to empty the water out, pour the beer into a fire bucket, and then take it back to our quarters. On the way back to our quarters, some bright person suggested, let's go down to Singapore. So we went out onto the Ras Pasha Road, and we got a cab. We took the cab into Singapore, and then we realized that nobody had any money. So there was a big Irishman called Sean Casey that was with us, and he says, well, don't worry, he says, you take the bucket of beer and head down the road, and I'll delay the cab driver. So we got out of the cab and we hustled down the road, and Casey explained to the cab driver that we didn't have any money, but would he take his watch or something like that. He was trying to negotiate some kind of an agreement, and the cab driver got mad and drove away, and obviously phoned the police. Next thing you know, we had police cars chasing us. I had the bucket of beer in my hand, and I thought, well, I'm going to get rid of this, so I threw it over a wall, and it must have been a greenhouse on the other side, because there was a big crash of glass and broken glass. So we took off down the road, but the police they caught us, and we spent the Saturday night in Orchard Road Police Station in the cells. In the morning, a police officer came in and took us out and said, the cab driver says that you didn't pay him. I said, well, maybe we didn't, but we didn't have any money. So anyway, we negotiated some kind of an agreement with them. And they said, okay, well, you can go now. So it was early Sunday morning, and he said, well, how are we going to get back to camp? And so I went back to the police station. I said, can I borrow your phone? I phoned the camp. I said, there's, I didn't tell them who was talking. I just said that there's a car broken down in Singapore, right outside Orchard Road Police Station. Could somebody come down and tow it back in? So we waited on the side of the road. About 30 minutes later, along comes a recovery vehicle. And they said, have you seen a car around here broken down? And I said, no, we haven't seen one around here, but if you're going back to the camp, you can give us a ride back. So we got our ride back to camp. The wife in Singapore at that time, of course, was everything was military there. The Army, Navy, and Air Force was in very strong attendance. There was many, many camps and bases. We liked to go out to Changi, the air base there. They had a nice beach just at the end of the runway. Where the planes would come over the water and touch down on the runway just beyond the beach. And we were there on the beach when the first commercial flight of the Comet came in to Singapore. So we watched the Comet come in, and it was the first, I think, passenger jet that had landed on Changi Airport. But life was pretty good. We really enjoyed our time in Malaya and, of course, Singapore. We did our jobs, and we did them well. We sort of lived hard and sort of played hard. We got into a bit of trouble, but nothing very serious. We got drunk and disorderly and things like that, but usually any CO or anything like that would frown on those kind of activities. But secretly, I think they said, well, this was the sort of thing that I did when I first joined the Army. And, they sort of overlooked our bad ways. Things began to come to a head as far as my stay in Singapore went. I was scheduled to be back in England on the 15th of December. That's when I left. My 3 years would have been up then. Finally, on orders, my name came up. I was to leave Singapore and travel on the Daneira, which was the ship I came out 3 years ago on. And I was to leave Singapore, I think it was the 14th or 15th of November, 1952. So I packed all my gear and got all my goodbyes said to all my friends that I'd made in Singapore. And I was actually quite sad to leave. Singapore had been my home for 3 years, and I'd enjoyed every minute of it. It had her ups and downs, but mostly it was a real good time. So in mid-November 1952, I got on the Daneira and started the voyage back to England. It was a comparatively uneventful voyage. The ship had been redone in 3 years, and instead of hammocks, they had bunks, the stand-easy bunks, so it made it a bit easier to live. And I enjoyed the trip back. We went back the same route, of course, through Colombo, Ceylon in those days, and then Aden and Port Said and Tripoli and Malta, Gibraltar, and finally we get back to Southampton. When we got off at Southampton, of course, we were passed through a sort of a customs check to make sure we didn't bring anything dangerous into the country. And then we were processed and given rental warrants and leave passes for, I think it was 30 days or 60 days leave that we were given. And I jumped on a train and took the train down to Dartmouth, Devon, where my parents still lived, and also my brother. And of course, at that time of the year in England, it was very damp, foggy, and wet, and really miserable for anybody that had been used to the tropical climate. But I took the train down and arrived at Dartmouth,